Monster Professor.
Welcome to The Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert, and today we're going to talk about Morlocks and Orcs. A friend asked me to do an episode on Morlocks, and I thought, man, do I have enough to say about Morlocks for a whole episode? The more I dug into it, the more I realized, yeah, I think I do, actually. There's a lot to say, and I love those guys. I've gotten requests for all sorts of things. The most requested monster, by the way, is the episode that's going to come up next week, so be prepared for that, because it might very well cover the thing that you asked me to cover, if you're listening to this. But that one's a little bit more suited for actual October, and so I wanted to hold back just a little bit longer. Today, Morlocks and Orcs can show up anytime, because they're underground, and they're right under your feet, and you don't know when they're going to pop up and get you. Except you do know, because it will be at night. It's not going to be at day, in the daylight. Alright, so what are Morlocks? Morlocks are these underground creatures, a race, a society, depending on how you want to see it. And they came from H.G. Wells's The Time Machine, which is an excellent novel and wildly influential. All sorts of writers grew out of that time machine, even if they weren't necessarily acknowledging that, maybe even sometimes not necessarily realizing that. And that's where I'm going to get to when by mixing orcs with Morlocks. And so we'll get to orcs in a minute. But Morlocks came first in the publication chronology, at least. And so H.G. Wells's Time Machine is this Victorian novel about this Victorian guy, the time traveler, and we never learn his name, in which he builds this time machine in his laboratory in England. He spends the first chapter explaining to us, the readers, but also, well, his audience, but essentially it's to the readers, saying, look, we can move around in three dimensions, but actually the universe is made of four dimensions, right? Not only height and width and depth, but time. And so, you know, they're objecting, wait, man can't move vertically at will. No, but we can build airplanes, you know, or balloons in that case, to take us up. And I can build something like that to take us forward and backward in time. And so he does. And he gets in his time machine. He moves forward to the year. It's like 800,000 BC, or like 850, I mean not BC, 850,000 AD, something like that. He goes way, way forward. And once he does, he steps across this threshold, he steps out of the time machine, and he's in what J.R.R. Tolkien would call fairyland. Now he's in this magical kind of paradise of mystery, and he's surrounded by what are essentially elves. The time traveler later learns that they call themselves Eloi. And not only does that kind of sound like elves, although not necessarily etymologically connected there, but they kind of live like Tolkien's elves, early elves, at least in The Hobbit, but in other places, they live kind of like that, where they have abundance, where they're carefree, they have no real manual labor that we can see, yet they are clothed and fed, and they live in these brilliantly, ingeniously constructed, ancient but clean temples. They have abundant food in a kind of Eden-like way, and they just laugh and skip, and they're kind of sexually ambiguous. You can't really tell which one's male, which one's female, or you can just barely tell. And it really doesn't make that much of a difference. They're just full of happiness and love. And so he spends some time around them. The only reason he doesn't just like the time traveler just doesn't just spend one day there and head back is because overnight his time machine gets stolen. And he thinks that these little innocent Eloi, which are smaller than human beings, smaller than normal of our era, he thinks they did it. So he's like bullying them and shaking them and beating them up and trying to get it out of them. They have no idea what's going on. They're just crying and screaming, and they're afraid of this big primitive man who has stepped out of time with them. He starts to realize that they are future versions of us. We eventually evolve through all sorts of luxury and through the elimination of manual labor. We evolve into these kinds of happy, carefree, but rather useless and weak kinds of aristocratic characters in which we just skip around and have a gay old time, and that's about that. But something else must be going on, because somebody or something stole his time machine where he left it, and now he is stuck here and he's got to figure it out. Well, he does figure it out. He notices that scattered throughout the land are these deep wells, but they don't end in water at the bottom. There are these ladders down into the wells, and they lead somewhere. And he starts to understand that these wells lead down to an underground city or an underground civilization, a whole other world underground. And out of these wells, every now and then, rise the Morlocks. They'll only rise on a new moon when there's the least amount of light in the sky. So these Morlocks are these creatures that are like back-bent and long-armed and long-legged, and that sometimes they tromp on all fours, sometimes they walk on two legs. They've got these huge eyes that are reflective of any light, and they're kind of albino, so they're very much cave-like creatures, but they're humanoid, but they're kind of like chinless and ugly. And the impression that I got out of them when I read the book is that they're like rat people, or maybe like mole people, but I think more like rat people. But in they've done film versions of these, and in the original film way back in the day, I'm going to screw up the year off the top of my head, but that film version, they're like blue-skinned and blonde-haired, and they're just kind of weird, ugly globule gorillas or something, and they're really dumb and weird. And then they did like a movie in the 90s of the Time Machine, in which they remade it, and those, they made them large, kind of ape-like human beings, a whole lot like Peter Jackson's orcs or Peter Jackson's Uruk-hai in his version of the Lord of the Rings. And so you've got these creatures down there, and the time traveler eventually goes down there to find out if he can find his time machine, because they must have stolen it and taken it into the underworld. And he gets attacked by them in their kind of way, and he realizes these are not kind of carefree, skipping around, happy creatures. These guys actually man all these underground machines. They make the clothes that the Eloi on the surface level wear. They kept everything going. They built everything. They made all of this stuff, and all of their big, like heavy, ugly, noisy machines down in the dark in the underground, and they still operate them. And he's guessing that at this point in their evolution, they don't even know how to build them. Maybe they don't even know what they do. They've just been working these machines for so many generations that all they know how to do anymore is continue to work the machines. But then when it's dark enough at night on the surface, they rise up out of their tunnels and they snatch up the Eloi and eat them. And so he starts to realize, oh no, these Morlocks are evolved humans too. that our human species split off into the aristocrats who owned everything, whether they're the capitalists or whether they're the politicians, whatever, however society started breaking apart. And then there were the manual laborers that generation after generation got put out of sight and into factories and then underground. And the ones who did all the work and all the labor, they got pushed away. And then the human species itself began to change and branch out into two different species of humanoid creatures. And the Morlocks are the manual laborers who have been shoved underground, seemingly by oppression. But what ended up happening is that the tables turned over the years, and the ones who could still do things are the ones who are eating the aristocrats like cattle. And so they have this messed up kind of symbiotic relationship. And the Morlocks continue to be, and the LOI's word for them are the Morlocks, and they continue to be the villains throughout this novel. But I can't help but root for these guys, man. They have, like, they're the ones who have to live underground. They're the ones who are capable and aware of what's going on. And they treat their cat, if the surface worlders or their cattle, they treat them quite well, right? They feed them, they clothe them until they're ready to harvest. And then here they come and they grab their food and they go back to what they do. But they're not really all that dumb. They're kind of smart in that the time traveler keeps trying to, like, use his power of fire to freak them out or to trick them and to one-up them. And they end up having this kind of battle one night. And then the next morning, the time traveler sees that his time machine is just sitting right inside this temple-like structure with the doors open, these doors wide open. He's like, wow, they're just giving up. They're giving me my time machine back. And then as soon as he walks in there to go toward it, he knows what is happening. The door shut behind him and the Morlocks are on him. It was a trap. They knew what he wanted and they knew how to trap him and get him into the darkness. And so there's this big brawl wrestling match through the dark until he can get on his time machine and just hit the levers randomly and just go as fast as possible away from there. At which point he ends up going way too far forward and he ends up in the earth and on planet Earth in the year like 30 million AD, like 30 million years from now, at which point it gets really nightmare-like and Lovecraftian. And I think Lovecraft was another writer who was hugely influenced by the time machine. But one writer who was quite clearly influenced by the time machine and by these Morlocks is, I would argue, J.R.R. Tolkien. Now, I've read a lot of Tolkien scholarship, and I've talked with some Tolkien scholars. I guess in some way or another, I might be one myself. And I have never run across anybody saying, well, Tolkien's orcs really come from H.G. Wells's Morlocks. But the more I thought about it for this episode, I thought, my God, they do. They really do. Tolkien, first of all, was hyper aware of the Morlocks. He actually, in his famous essay, an excellent essay, by the way, called On Fairy Stories, How Fantasy Works and How It Doesn't and why it matters. That's all in his very long and brilliant essay called On Fairy Stories. And he mentions Morlocks in there like two or three times. At first, disparagingly, in which he's like, well, you know, non-fantasy stories, you know, these kinds of science fiction stories like the time machine, but the time machine is absurd, by the way, and like this one machine has no energy, so blah, 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 whatever. But then he talks himself into admitting that the time machine was actually a pretty good fantasy, and the Morlocks themselves were really good for what they are. And so I would say that a large part of what he envisioned his orcs to be are essentially Morlocks. They are these backbent gangly armed creatures that live in the darkness with these big eyes. And although they can go out in the daylight, they don't like the light and they don't like the daylight, and they're kind of weakened by it, right? Just like Morlocks. They tend to live in underground places, whether it's the mines of Moria or in underground caves, like the Morlocks. In fact, when they're first introduced in The Hobbit, they're not called orcs yet, because Tolkien later realized that the word he preferred for these creatures was orcs. At first in The Hobbit, they're just called goblins, and he regretted that later, but, you know, it had already been published and had been famous for quite a while, so he just stuck with it. Here's what he says about these orcs, in which he calls them goblins, interchangeable here in The Hobbit. "Now goblins are cruel, wicked, and bad-hearted. They make no beautiful things, but they make many clever ones. They can tunnel and mine as well as any but the most skilled dwarves when they take the trouble, though they are usually untidy and dirty. Hammers, axes, swords, daggers, pickaxes, tongs, and also instruments of torture. They make very well, or get other people to make to their design, prisoners and slaves that have to work till they die for want of air and light. It is not unlikely that they invented some of the machines that have since troubled the world, especially the ingenious devices for killing large numbers of people at once, for wheels and engines and explosions always delighted them, and not working with their own hands more than they could help. But in those days, in those wild parts, they had not advanced, as it is called, so far." So in that excerpt, you get a glimpse of what he saw to be these orcs and goblins, these horrid underground kinds of beings that worked really hard, worked hard to not work hard, to use other people as slaves or prisoners or even cattle. And they were the makers of machines, even the inventors of machines, the kinds of machines that Tolkien eventually saw firsthand in World War I, or that his son was a part of in World War II, right? Or that we continue to be to this day. So rather than having his monsters way forward in time as Morlocks, as H.G. Wells did, he threw his way back in time and put them not at the far end of the machines, but at the far beginning of the machines. And so in these ways, and in many more, I think we're looking at a slightly different version of Morlock. But orcs overall, they're an interesting group. I mean, they're essentially a little bit smaller than the average human being, just like the Morlocks were. There are a crossbreed, though, that Saruman's responsible for, the white wizard who turns corrupted and ends up being a villain in The Lord of the Rings. And he supposedly bred human beings and orcs, put them together, and made the Uruk-hai, who are larger, tougher, and then the big advantage that they offer as a species of slaves and soldiers is that they're not nearly as disadvantaged by sunlight, so they can keep attacking or they can keep moving in daylight just as easily, whereas normal orcs have a hard time with that. So if Morlocks came from human beings who were the more oppressed manual laborers and workers and factory workers who had to keep living in squalid life in squalid areas until they were shoved underground, and then they lived there for thousands, hundreds of thousands of years until they became something different, the Morlocks. If that's where they came from, what are the origins of orcs? Well, in Tolkien's world, you get a few different theories, and it's in the way that I think Tolkien wasn't quite sure himself where these came from. But that's just conjecture. Instead, he lets the characters in his world be a little bit unsure of where they came from. we get from him the Silmarillion, which are essentially the legends of the elves and the legends that the elves have told each other about their own origins. And that we get, of course, an elf-centric history of orcs. They believe that the Dark Lord Morgoth Melkor, the Dark Lord from the very beginning of time in Tolkien's world, of whom Sauron, the big evil villain of Lord of the Rings, was just a lieutenant to great Morgoth Melkor himself. The legend goes among the elves that Morgoth captured a bunch of elves and then tortured them and manipulated them and did horrid experiments on them until he had twisted them down into these monstrous little creatures. That's where orcs came from. They became orcs, and so all these orcs were once elves. And from then, they bred like normal creatures do until they populate the dark places of the world. That's one theory. Others came up earlier and later. There were others that suggested that, oh, maybe he took men and tortured and twisted them, or maybe men and elves, or there was one in which he just like took underworld slime and heat and put them together and formed something. The problem for Tolkien, though, is that Melkor was true evil, and true evil in his universe can't actually create. It can destroy and it can manipulate, but it can't create life out of the blue. And so so there's plenty of reason to think that the one that he really wanted to go with was evil took something good and twisted it down into something bad, like the orcs, because they're bad at their heart. But you could say, well, isn't that kind of like a little bit too black and white, good and evil? I hear some people accuse The Lord of the Rings as being kind of a black and white, good and evil story. And that certainly can only be a criticism from people who haven't actually read Lord of the Rings, or who, after having done so, haven't thought about it too much, because that is a book of all gray area and a really complex and advanced thinking on the nature of what evil is. And in that world, it's a whole bunch of gray area stuff. You could say, well, except for the orcs. I mean, they're always very killable, right? Anytime you have a battle with orcs, the good guys just slaughter a whole bunch of them. Okay, well, the Time Traveler did, by the way, too, just very quickly and easily slaughter a whole bunch of Morlocks, or at least best of them, but probably killed a whole bunch of them just barehanded. And so there's something about both of these that are smaller and weaker, but evil, but their numbers keep coming at you until they are a serious threat. Well, okay, so if that's the case, then it's not fully realized unless we get to see a moment, maybe from the orc's perspective. Well, in the final book of The Lord of the Rings, in the Return of the King, or the final volume, Return of the King, we get a moment in which Samwise overhears two different units, military units of orcs, encountering each other in Cirith Ungol, where Shelob the spider is, and they start discussing, you know, the nature of the war and the nature of their own government with each other. One of them's named Shagrat, the other is named Grishnak, and he overhears this discussion between them, in which they're complaining about the situation and that they just lost these two. They don't know what they are. They don't quite know they're hobbits, but essentially they're trying to track down Frodo and Sam, and they're concerned that they haven't really caught this Samwise character yet, and so they mistake him for an elf. But as they're arguing, they're like giving us little hints about what it's like to be an orc in wartime. They're like, watch what you say. You know, the big bosses are listening. They're always listening. You're like, well, yeah, but I answer to this boss. And well, I answer to that boss. And my boss is a bigger boss than your boss. But no matter what, we got to watch what we say. And if you've ever been in a kind of tyrannical institution or any sort of whether it's a job or a family or a nation or whatever it is, you know that one of the first stages of knowing you're in a tyranny is you have to watch what you say, especially if you think they are always listening. And that's what we have with these orcs. They start arguing as to whose fault it is, essentially who's going to get blamed for things going wrong at the ground level in this situation they're in. And so neither one of them wants to take blame for it. They always want to blame the others. And they have slightly different hierarchical systems in that they answer to different arms of Sauron's evil forces, and so they argue about that. But there's almost a sweet moment when they say to each other, man, when the war is over, you and I, we should just head on up to some out into the mountains, you know, we should get a little homestead out there, get ourselves set up. And every now and then go on raids, go on, you know, go kill some people and take their stuff and come on back and party and just have a little world to ourselves. Like, we can be our own bosses, you know. And I was like, yeah, let's do that. When the war's over, man, we're going to get together. We'll have a good time. And you're starting to feel for them, like, oh, man, they just, all they want is the same kinds of things that most other regular people want. But by the end of that whole conversation, they're stabbing each other in the face. They turn on each other really quickly, which shows you a little bit of their true nature, that yeah, they might want to work together and want good things for each other and themselves if given the opportunity, but if they could just stab their best friend in the back and get something a little bit quicker, they'll take that route. And so that's what you get over the orcs. Why did Tolkien switch from goblins to orcs, by the way? That's a good question. And where did he get this word orcs? Because it didn't really show up like a lot of words that we have for certain types of monsters, and a lot of ideas that we have in like fantasy fiction, that all started with, a lot of them, I'm not saying all, that's the wrong word, a lot of them started with Tolkien, right? We didn't really have orcs until Tolkien. So where did he get this, and why do you want to switch? Well, for him, goblin was a little bit too Latinate. He wanted some good, solid, old English words. And he noticed that orc, or orcus, or orcian, showed up in Beowulf, meaning these kinds of evil spirits. And there's reason to think that it came into Beowulf from some Latin for Orcus, the god of the underworld, and related very much to Pluto or to Hades. And so Orcus, this underworld evil god, becomes eventually these like little evil spirits that Tolkien eventually uses as orcs, his name for these goblin kind of characters. And so he does draw from Old English in that way. So why do I like things like Morlocks so much? Well, that's a good question. My heart goes out to outcasts and underdog. I think most people's heart goes out to underdogs, but outcasts are a little bit different. Those kind of people who are underground, the whole idea that there are underground cities going on right under your feet all the time, and you just never know it. When you're like, oh, nothing's going on, or when you're asleep at night, under your bed or under your boots, there is a whole world of living, moving things going on. While you're having, say, a normal Thanksgiving dinner with your family, There are groups of people out there that are doing some really freaky, weird things, and they're just loving it, and they can't get enough of themselves, even though you would find it completely disturbing or disgusting or something. And for me, like, the best word for those kinds of outcasts and freaks, I mean, they're just kind of like Morlocks, aren't they? And you see that idea come up in all sorts of other stories. There's like a late 80s, early 90s film, I think it was Clive Barker, called Nightbreed, in which you've got this cool young guy in a leather jacket or whatever, and he goes into the cemetery, down into this mausoleum with stairs that lead to this deeper underground world. And under there, you have all these monsters who are mostly kind of freakish mutants. And they're not like sexy, cool, like Dracula monsters. Most of them are just gross and weird. And they're just a whole bunch of people who just want to do their own thing, kind of be left alone. They don't even really want to prey on anybody. It's actually the surface worlders that are the evil ones, and they just have to live under here and just try to get by on their own. And they're gross and weird, but they're totally fine with themselves. And I love that kind of thing. I think that, I mentioned before in an earlier podcast that Todd Browning's film that he did right after the famous Dracula film is one called Freaks, 1932. And a lot of people are disturbed by that film, and rightly so, because he gets real circus freaks that are kind of disturbing to watch and look at for real. And in this film, even though there's a whole bunch of like love triangle, murder mystery drama among these freaks and these circus people, that essentially all these kind of freaks are a close-knit little family, and they just adore what they do. They will dance a jig and sing amongst themselves and clap and just have a grand old time, and they're not bothered by the fact that the whole rest of the normal world considers them to be just absolutely disturbing and terrifying. They like it just fine. Those are my people, man. I mean, what would be a different version of this kind of Morlockian culture, this underground culture that just is completely pleased with itself, even though the rest of the world is disgusted by it. I guess like John Waters' Dreamlanders come to mind. So for John Waters, the Dreamlanders are the name for this crew that John Waters worked with, or John Waters and his crew are the Dreamlanders. And you've got Divine, you know, this huge outgoing drag queen that's just the queen of filth and disgust. And then you've got all these other, you know, in Pink Flamingos, for instance, you know, you've got her mother, this old woman and this little baby cage that's just in love with the guy who delivers the eggs, the Eggman. She loves eggs and she loves the Eggman, and she just wears a diaper and she's an old woman, and it's just so disturbing to so many people. And then Divine's children, you know, Cotton and Crackers, and they have this incestuous relationship and they're all happy with themselves. In fact, they just want to be the filthiest people on planet Earth. And the whole movie is this competition between this other couple that consider themselves to be the filthiest. And so this battle for who's filthiest. And I just can't get enough of it. I just think it's so delightful and adorable to watch this kind of thing. You see, I don't know, where else does this kind of Morlock theme pop up? In Futurama, there's the Simpsons people went a sci-fi direction for a show called Futurama. And in that world, there's the sewer mutants, this underground city, that is under New York City, all through the sewers. And you've got all these mutants down there that they have their own culture. They have their own society and they're perfectly happy. And I think the Futurama tells the story that, you know, they were just the the sewer workers or the sanitation workers way back in the day in New York City until things started going bad and the surface worlder people sealed up all the exits. And so they had to just build their own radioactive sludge infested society on themselves. They, if I'm remembering correctly, in Futurama, as the characters are getting this tour of this underground world among the sewer mutants, they see this like this yet to be detonated nuclear missile down there, and they're like, "This, we worship this as our god," but most of us aren't really, you know, active believers. It's more of like a Christmas and Easter kind of thing. And so it's a real culture, because who doesn't do that? Marvel Comics had a whole group of, they actually just flat out called them the Morlocks, right? They weren't even trying to adjust it any, in which you've got these, the mutants, but the ones who aren't as sexy and cool as the ones who get recruited into the X-Men Academy, they're all just kind of ugly with weird powers, and so they tended to live underground in the sewers. Or the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, right? Aren't these the kind of outcast mutants who live underground, in our case, in the sewers down there? Although the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, that doesn't even seem accurate, right? Because they're not turtles. Turtles are the aquatic ones with the flippers. Aren't they tortoises? And so they'd be more like... And they're not, I mean, they're tortoises, but they're not essentially tortoises. They're mutants, all right, that are just kind of have tortoise-like things. So I think the more accurate phrase would be like teenaged ninja tortoise mutants. I think that's what they meant them to be. Anyway, so let's see. So that was a pretty solid discussion of Morlocks and orcs. Of course, there are a lot more to say on both of those, but I feel like that's pretty good for today. But this is at least one response to a request. Like I said, next episode, I'm holding back, but I'm gonna release it. The most requested monster that I get for the first weekend of Halloween is coming next. But if you have other requests, other comments, just let me know. You can contact me on my website, joshwoodsauthor.com. You can also see what other kinds of things I have going on there. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I'll talk to you next time on The Monster Professor.